You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 188 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
And
we, again, have a lot of podcasting to do.
Not a lot of different subjects, but a lot going on with those subjects, I guess I would say.
Well, and a lot of podcasting to do this week, as we did last week. If you haven't done so yet, please go back and listen to the Peltoncast Decade in Music that we released last week. Many are saying it was the best Peltoncast Decade in Music ever.
That's true. They also saying the worst Peltoncast Decade in Music yet.
So. Bottom five. But if you haven't listened to that, it's timeless.
Yes, to a degree it is. But coming up later this week, we will, of course, be recording our other annual traditional podcast, wow, in decade traditional podcast now, as it has become tradition, the Seattle Sports Year and Decade in Review, coming later this week with bold predictions, of which I have to make one first.
Oh, man. I'm so excited to revisit our bold predictions from last year.
I've revisited mine. I'm not so excited to revisit them. I was considering as a bold prediction, Pete Carroll goes for a fourth down, but then he blew that out of the way by going for it at the
in Carolina. Went for a fourth down.
A single fourth down. Just one.
And also, well, we should crack open the beer for this.
We should.
So we're drinking here today for the holidays from Pyramid Brewing Company, the Snowcap Winter Ale.
This is our last beer of meteorological winter, but not actual winter.
There we go. Did you look that up?
I did.
And I was right, wasn't I?
You were correct.
I said astrological, not meteorological. Well,
that is pretty different from that meteorological, if we're being technical here. But look, you're not
astrological winter.
You're not an expert in years.
Same thing. They both had the word logical.
Biological winter? I don't think I want to know what biological winter is.
I've reached my biological winter.
Oh, dear. Oh, no.
Now is the dawn of our biological winter. So we're enjoying Snowcap from our friends at Pyramid Brewing Company. Here's what they say about Snowcap Winter Ale. Inspired by the whitewashed peaks of the Cascades, Snowcap is one of the originals that helps start the winter beer craze. Dark brown and full-bodied, this timeless seasonal offering features richly woven flavors from a flurry of flavorful dark malts and a pleasant hop bitterness. Perfect to enjoy in your biological winter. A little cocky there, Snowcap bottle, right?
One of the first?
One of the originals that helped start the winter beer craze? Like,
I don't know that I can speak to that either way.
It's like just vague enough that you can't disprove it. It's also a statement on a beer bottle, so nobody's really trying to disprove it.
Are those checked?
It's probably the most confident statement that we've seen on any beer bottle that we've ever had, though.
I feel like there's maybe some more tongue-in-cheek statements that were more confident.
Okay. Well, here's to hoping that Pyramid isn't in its biological winter.
Oh, dear. Well, besides astrological winter, you know what time of year it is. It's the fantasy football playoffs.
It sure is. Raise your hand if you're in this room and you're in a fantasy football championship. It's the only fantasy genius in the room who's raising their hand. And I wanted to say good luck to everybody who is in. This is a sincere good luck. Good luck to everybody who is in their fantasy football playoffs, especially the two teams that have to play against me in the fantasy football playoffs, because you're going to need it.
Oh, boy.
Two out of three leagues in the finals.
Two out of three leagues, number one in points scored during the regular season, lost in the semifinals in both leagues. You know how I know it's astrological winter? Because my fantasy football players go into hibernation.
I think it might be biological winter for your fantasy football players.
It wasn't for Christian McCaffrey, but the rest of the team, not so hot.
Lukey Crowley, Katie, Carcino.
The famous cousin Katie.
Watch yourselves.
I mean, I figured
I lost Chris Godwin, though, so I don't know.
I figured I had a pretty good chance of making the finals in one league because the famous Cousin Katie's team featured Deshaun Watson and Christian McCaffrey, who were also the two top players on my team in the PeltonCast league. Yes. I was in the semifinals in. So I'm like, you know, odds are I'm going to win one of these two, but probably not both of them, and somehow still lost to both of them.
Your team, I don't know if this can be proven statistically, but you at fantasy football are the worst playoff fantasy football player on earth.
I'm basically like the George Carl of fantasy football. Like, my teams are consistently pretty solid in the regular season. Then come playoff time.
Have you ever won a championship?
Upset by the Nuggets. Oh, no.
So I could hypothetically win two more championships this year than you ever have in your entire life?
You can't tell, but I'm making a bitter beer face. It's the face I would make if I were drinking sour beer had I lost a bet to you on the finals in our family league, but I didn't even make it there, so you're going to have to make that bet with Katie.
Maybe you were being merciful to yourself by just getting the loss out of the way in the first round of the playoffs instead of waiting for the finals.
So we invited the famous Cousin Katie on the podcast tonight to
gloat. And she was scared!
She was not scared. She said she couldn't make it because she has jury duty in the morning. That said, pass along that Al sucks at fantasy football.
Always. Always. So,
there you go.
You've
That's
never
your message.
Won? How many years have we been playing fantasy football?
In that league, at least 13. I think 13 years in the family league. And then we've done 2 years now at the PeltonCast leagues. So,
how many championships do you think I've won in that time period? I also played in another fantasy football league that was only for 1 year, and I won that one, too.
You definitely won at least 7 in our family league, but probably more than that.
This is my best PeltonCast fantasy football team, though. This is our third year of doing it, or second year?
I guess it's third year, isn't it? I think it's the third year.
This is the first time in PeltonCast fantasy football that I've even been in the playoffs.
Some of us consistently making the playoffs in PeltonCast and just, again, flaming out there in spectacular
all right, well,
fashion.
Well, who else is participating in all the PeltonCast fantasy football
leagues? Yeah, good luck to these teams. In the PeltonCast Champions League, we have the Ramblin' Rum Springa.
They were scared to let me into the Champions League.
Self-proclaimed fantasy genius Jimmer has been calling himself that for a while and has a chance to back it up with another
genius spelled with a J. By the way, Jimmer, you were playing against Kevin Pelton, not Tristan Carcino in this league, for the record.
Against the Honor Oakhawks in the home of Super Bowl 48 Champs League, we have your Talk and Taco team. Let's say that 5 times fast. Versus, as you mentioned, the listener Lukey Crowley with Tom Brady as a system quarterback. In Tai Totem's Country League, we have C. Mike Did Some Things Wrong versus Seattle Prospects.
That team is a beast.
A controversial take, but an uncontroversially good team. And then finally, in the PeltonCast Economist Friends League, we have Shoddy's Football Dive Bar that took me out, the Pagliacci Primas, versus They're There, No Thanks. So good luck to everyone in the finals. All right, let's get to our real toasts, or our other toasts.
I was going to say, that toast was very real to some
of us.
Well,
we actually never toasted. It was part of it.
Well, there we go.
So that's not a real toast. Next up, to the Seahawks. For clinching their 8th playoff appearance in Pete Carroll's 10 years as head coach, representing 44% of the 18 total playoff appearances in franchise history. So we will keep that in mind the next time we go into a rant about how terrible Pete Carroll is.
Oh, just later today.
is it going to be today?
I mean, at least a little bit.
There was another 4th down he didn't go for.
We're going to talk about that.
Are we? I didn't realize that. To Walter Jones, who was named last week to the NFL 100 all-time team, as revealed on the NFL Network broadcast. He's the second former Seahawk to make the team so far, joining return specialist and Seahawks legend, Devin Hester. Yeah. Always remember Devin Hester's 8 games with the Seahawks.
Including like 8 games?
I don't know how many it actually is. No, it's like 5. He got the final month. There was 2 playoff games.
It was the Lions and then the Falcons, is that right?
That sounds about right. The wide receiver and quarterback stats are still to be revealed. So, well, Russell Wilson will probably be shamefully snubbed from this team. There is a chance that Steve Largent will join. Walter Jones is a Seahawk representative who played his entire career for the team. And then lastly, as far as the toasts go, to UW Volleyball, we're pouring some out as well, as their season came to an end with a 3-1 loss to number one overall seed Baylor Saturday in the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament after they reached that with a win on Friday. So still a great season for UW Volleyball. And with both UW Volleyball and men's soccer losing the Elite Eight, it is unclear what kind of school we are until we become a crew school in the spring. All right, with those in the books, let's get to our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle, and so do we.
So there's an interesting piece of news last week that I don't know if you even really picked up on this. The NBA announced ahead of the two games they played in Mexico City last week that they are bringing a G League expansion franchise to Mexico City starting next season as the 29th team in the G League. Were you aware of this?
No, not at all.
Do you know why this affects Seattle?
Why? I mean, I can venture a guess.
But yeah, you could probably put the pieces together.
Why does this affect Seattle?
So expansion, if that's how you're hoping to get a team, and you know there's no clear relocation possibilities anytime soon, in part because of a bit of news that we'll get to in a second here, if you're hoping for expansion, it's probably tied as a timetable to when the NBA is ready to put a franchise in Mexico City, because that would almost certainly be an expansion team. Possibly this G League franchise, which is going to be independently owned. They're basically converting a franchise that has been playing basketball in Mexico into a G League franchise, although obviously with new players.
What franchise is that?
Capitanes, I believe.
Okay.
I don't remember that off the top of my head, but that's...
They're just like an independent Mexican basketball team?
I'm not entirely sure. I assume they play in a league, but I don't know a lot about the league they play in. Okay. My knowledge of the Mexican basketball leagues is
shameful,
sadly scarce.
Wow.
Anyways, presumably they would eventually try to convert that just into an NBA franchise once they've kind of shown proof of concept that there's a fan base ready for this and that the infrastructure is there to play 41 times a year in Mexico City instead of the two games that have been played there on an annual basis in recent years. And when that happens, the NBA will probably expand with two teams because of the fact that it's nice to have an even number, and 32 is a good number of teams to have for a league when you're sorting them out into divisions. It gives you, even though their in-season tournament plan doesn't incorporate all 32 teams in the actual tournament right now, it gives you an even number for a tournament. Well, the proposal that's on the table for the in-season tournament that they talked about a few weeks ago, it would basically like the play-in games would be determined by regular season games between teams and divisions, and the winners of the divisions and then two wild cards would then go on to an 8-team playoff tournament. You're looking at me quizzically here.
I'm gonna need a lot more info broken down for me about that later.
It's gonna be very similar to the CONCACAF Champions League, I think.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So this is actually a positive, though, because
yes.
My understanding, if I was going to venture a guess about why this mattered for Seattle, was probably considering it as a negative. But you're telling me that...
In terms of competition for another city to move to?
Yes. But basically what you're saying is if the NBA were to expand...
I'm saying the only way the NBA is going to expand is if it expands to Mexico City.
Because you think that the NBA cares so much about basketball in Mexico that they're basically willing to give up two slices of the pie of the TV money revenue to get into Mexico.
Eventually. I mean, I you know, this is not a certainty, but I think that's what their long-term thinking and planning is, that if you were able to make the entire country of Mexico, give them their first taste of American pro sports with the NBA, that would be worth divvying up the pool.
And at that time, they also would be willing to divide the money even further. They've basically fixed the Seattle problem.
I mean, so the other thing, you know, I have like gotten some like very low level intel that Seattle would, in that scenario, be ahead of Las Vegas as an expansion possibility.
Oh, no shit. Just like,
I mean, that's the real competition.
Seattle has to be at the top.
But the other situation here is like, The reason I think it's likely to be expansion is I don't think if you're a current owner that you'd want to move your team to Mexico City. I think you'd want new local ownership there. So that's why expansion, I think, makes more sense than relocation there. But, you know, unless relocation becomes a possibility, I'm sure, you know, we, having been through this process, would prefer if Seattle gets a team back, it would be through expansion, ideally, rather than relocation of another team.
So this is interesting news, though.
Yeah. And it was something that had been mooted previously. It had been in the works, but important to have it become official. So the other bit of news I talked about happened in California relating to the LA Clippers. Last week, California Governor Gavin Newsom certified the Clippers Arena project. And if this certification is approved by the Joint Legislative Budget Committee of California, it would reduce the timeline for lawsuits and the environmental impact study for the Clippers' proposed new arena, to 9 months, which would clear the way for them, assuming those lawsuits are resolved in their favor, to potentially begin building the arena in time to have it ready for the 2024-25 season when their lease expires at Staples Center. So, you know, if you're hoping for Steve Ballmer to move the Clippers to Seattle, which is not happening, bad news in that regard.
I don't think any reasonable person thought that this was going to happen.
Maybe before they signed Kawhi Leonard and Paul George and traded for Paul George, who happened to both be from the Southern California area.
Well, just even then. I mean, we knew the logistics of it, of paying $2 billion to move a team to Seattle. It was unreasonable.
Well, I mean, a Seattle franchise at this point would probably be worth $2 billion. Like, the median valuation now of an NBA team is only a little under two.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But Steve Ballmer bought a team to be in LA.
Yes. Staying on the basketball front, let's talk about UW men's basketball, which has been off for the last week for finals, but returns to action on Tuesday night, hosting crosstown rivals Seattle University ahead of traveling to Honolulu for the Diamond Head Classic, which will tip off on Sunday against Ball State. Huskies, by being idle, returned to the AP poll at number 22. Excellent work for them last week.
Huge.
Moved up five spots. Also number 22 in the coaches' poll. Seattle U comes in 6-5, have won their last four games, but the highest-ranked opponent of that group on KenPom was number 236, Portland. The Red Hawks lost by 31 at Wazoo early in the season and lost by 22 at struggling Syracuse, but were competitive in another game against a Power 5 school at Ole Miss, losing by 13 in that one. Seattle U rarely turns the ball over, but just hasn't been able to make shots this season. They're making 42% of their threes, or their twos, and 28% of their threes so far this season, which is bad news against the UW zone defense. They are 334th in the nation overall in effective field goal percentage. They also force very few turnovers and foul frequently. If you were designing a team for the Huskies to play against in the lab, it would look a lot like the Seattle U team does.
I was going to say, some other teams in Seattle turn the ball over all the time and also can't make shots.
They're a little better than that. They're not 334th in effective field goal percentage.
Who is the coach of Seattle U right now?
Jim Hayforth, who was at Eastern Washington previously. So, you know, he's done a reasonably good job there.
Was basically a promotion for him, though. He moved up to Seattle U from Eastern.
Yeah, I think probably his hope was that, you know, it's a little bit easier to recruit to Seattle U than it is to Cheney. So I think from that standpoint, even though Eastern has probably been, they're a better ranked team so far this season, I think that's why Jim Hayford decided to take this job. Looking ahead to the Diamond Head Classic, the opening opponent for the Huskies, Ball State, is ranked number 113 in KenPom, despite just a 4-4 record against Division I competition. They've won blowouts for their four wins by an average of margin of 28 points per game. Their four losses have come by 25 points total, by contrast. Have yet to face any major conference competition this season. Nearly half of their attempts are threes, and they make 36.5% of them. So that is not a team that you would draw up in the lab that you want to see play against the Huskies zone. But on the plus side, Ball State has no regulars bigger than 6'8", 215. So Isaiah Stewart could be a bit of a challenge for their front court. Intriguingly, they almost never allow teams to take threes either. They're in the bottom 20 in the country of that. And despite the lack of size, have held opponents to less than 40% two-point shooting. So a really strong interior defense. It seems kind of like a Utah Jazz kind of setup where, you know, they're defending shots well at the rim and just not allowing threes. Overall, though, I'd still say a favorable draw for the Huskies is on their side of the bracket, they have UTEP or Hawaii awaiting in round two. You know, two teams that also rank in the hundreds in KenPom, though Hawaii has the home court advantage in this tournament that they are essentially hosting in Honolulu. On the other side of the bracket lurking is Houston, who's actually the highest ranked of these teams in KenPom, and a potential opponent for the Huskies should those two teams make it to the final.
Not that we would want to do this, but should we go into the Diamond Head Classic expecting the Huskies to win the tournament?
I mean, Houston's a better ranked team than KenPom. They don't have any strong wins this season. They've lost all three of their games against top 50 competition, but they've also, you know, comfortably dominated the other teams they've faced. So I think it would be a pretty good matchup if those two teams got to that point, but I think you should expect them to get to the final and then have a chance to win.
Is Houston a good enough school or well-received enough nationally that a loss to them isn't devastating?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, they were a pretty prominent NCAA tournament team the last couple of years. They beat last year, they beat Oregon at home as part of a home-and-home. They beat them. I think that was, if I recall correctly, I think that was their first game in their new building. They brought in Oregon to open that up. They made it to the Sweet 16. This is not as strong a team as last year's team was. They lost, you know, some seniors off of that team, but they've been a really competitive team under Kelvin Sampson. The previous year were favored to go to the Sweet 16 and law, or not necessarily favored, but Michigan beat them on a buzzer beater to keep them from going. Otherwise, they would have been in the Sweet 16 in back-to-back years. So this
okay,
is
so
a legit
Houston has
team.
A profile.
Yeah, for sure.
I just haven't been paying any attention at all.
Clearly not. Why do you even watch college basketball?
When you said that Houston was in the Sweet 16 last year, that was pretty shocking to me.
I had forgotten specifically that they were in the Sweet 16. They beat Ohio State in the second round and then lost to Kentucky 62-58. So they were very not far from the Elite Eight, but they lost a couple of seniors, and then Armani Brooks went pro from that team, and I believe is playing in the G League. So, yeah.
Well, maybe he'll be playing in Mexico City soon.
Maybe we'll be playing in Las Vegas, the G League Showcase, where I'll be covering later this week.
Oh, hello.
UW women's basketball.
What is your plan, speaking of the G League Showcase?
For eating?
Yes.
I haven't really developed a strong plan yet. There's been talk
How many
of,
days are you in Vegas?
I'm there Thursday through Sunday night.
Sunday night?
Yeah.
So you will be in attendance at your second consecutive Husky Bowl game?
That is correct.
Wow.
We'll get to that in a second.
Okay. But so you haven't developed an eating plan for Vegas. Are you going to the brand newly opened?
I don't...
Are you going to the newly opened Major Domo?
I would have interest in going to it, certainly. It appears to that the menu is very different from the Major Domo in LA, from what I can glean. A friend of mine covered the grand opening of it last weekend. So when I looked last week, Nate Duncan will be in town as well.
Oh, wow.
We have plans for a dinner on Friday night. And so I would be interested in that. But they weren't taking reservations when we looked last week. I'm not sure if they are yet now.
Why wouldn't they be taking reservations?
Well, they weren't technically open. It was like last weekend was their actual opening. It was surprising that they wouldn't. Or maybe they're just completely booked up, you know, in-house through then. So I don't know exactly what's going on. But
you and Nate Duncan don't hold the kind of clout in Vegas.
Well, I haven't tried just yet. Maybe we need to try. The other thing that's happening in the G League Showcase, I'm doing some TV.
Really?
I'm doing sideline reporting on Thursday night for the games on the first day of the G League Showcase tournament.
Nate Duncan will be like, I know the code word. Cap space.
It's easy to remember.
That's how I get a reservation here. So you're going to be doing TV work at the G League Showcase?
I will be doing sideline reporting on the two night games Thursday night.
What does that mean at the G League Showcase, and where can we see this?
ESPNU, I believe, is the broadcast.
Oh, wow. So you're going to be on, this is not ESPN Plus, you're going to be on television.
I'd have to double check that, but I think that's the case.
Man, I'm going to have to set my DVR.
So that would be like walk-off interviews. You know, drop-ins perhaps during the broadcast, sideline interviews, because there will be many luminaries in attendance.
Wow. Like Nate Duncan. I'm here with Nate Duncan.
Nate wasn't who I was thinking of. I talked about this with...
Who would you be interviewing?
Like, the suggestion was like, oh, if Daryl Morey's on the sidelines, like the real Grand Valley team is not one of the teams that's playing during that period, but, you know, maybe one of the GMs of those teams, that sort of thing.
Celebrities.
Yeah. It's not open to the public, so I don't know that there's a lot of G-League celebrities. The G-League
showcase isn't open to the public?
It is not.
Wow. I bet I could talk my way in.
Also, it's very weird to be going to Vegas. So I've never been to Vegas outside the month of July in my life.
Really?
I've been to Vegas. I'd have to... this is too much math that for me can't to do off true. The top of my... No, it is 100% true. I have been to Summer League, and then one time we went as a family trip during what would have been Summer League, except it was the lockout year.
Oh, wow.
So I've been there now each of the last 8 years or 9 years, plus one other time. So I've been there 10 times in the month of July, never been there outside of it. And I just looked up the weather and it turns out it's going to be like half the temperature I'm used to in Vegas. Like literally
half. You're like, well, Vegas is always 115 degrees.
I mean, I joke about that, but it kind of seems that way in my imagination. So the fact that it's like in the mid 50s next week is shocking information to me.
Is it really?
Yeah.
How cold does it get?
It's going to be below 40 is a low.
Wow. I mean, it is the desert. Yes. What does it cost to fly to Vegas in the like cold season? Is it crazy cheap?
I don't think it's crazy cheap. I mean, there's still NFL season. Like people enjoy going there to gamble during the weekends, yes. Which is when I'm going. If you went Monday through Wednesday, it'd probably be really cheap.
Crazy cheap. Yeah, it's not even that good of like LA is still hot right now.
It's like at least 60s probably.
So, like, L.A. would be a nicer place if you just wanted to go get sunshine or whatever. Palm Springs, probably.
Yes.
Interesting. Oh, wait. So, this is going to be ESPNU.
I'm still double-checking this. Like, I need to...
I need to set my DVR for this. I have to see this.
I mean, yes, understandably so.
This is purely just for my own personal information.
No, it may just be ESPN. Oh, no, this is the last week's games that I'm looking at. I see... Where are next week's games?
This is the fun part of the podcast where Kevin looks something up.
Yeah, it's ESPNU.
ESPN, what day, what time?
Thursday night, it will be the games at 5 o'clock and 7:30 Pacific.
December 19th?
That is correct, yes.
Which games?
5 and 7:30 p.m.
Who's playing?
The Capital City Go-Go versus the Iowa Wolves at 5 p.m. And the Sioux Falls Sky Force.
They sound like teams in a Simpsons episode.
The Sioux Falls Sky Force, which I had to look up who they were affiliated with. I had forgotten that. Versus the Agua Caliente Clippers at 7:30.
The Agua Caliente Clippers?
Yes. They're named after the Agua Caliente tribe and resort.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to DVRing this.
Yeah.
Because even if it's only 60 degrees in Vegas, there will be sweat on the screen.
Oh, no. I mean, the number one fear is the microphone shaking back and forth. But the good news is here, it's not like a stand-up hit on television. They can just cut to something else. So I feel like that's an upside here for me.
That they can cut to something else?
Yeah, they can just show a photo of the bench or something. I don't know.
Do you think that there's any way that you could sort of like you're not nervous right now, right?
A little nervous. A little flop sweat.
Is there any way that you could basically just be like, calm your body down and just be like, stop?
You know what the good thing about anxiety is? When you think about not being nervous, it really helps you not be nervous.
I'm trying to think about what I've been able to do, like, if I'm doing a TV interview and I'm just like, you know what? Like, it takes like a second and then I'm just like, this is fine.
I mean, it's fine when I'm sitting down. It's only been when I've been standing up holding a microphone that it's ever been an issue.
It's the standing and holding a microphone?
I don't know.
Sitting right now? So what we're doing right here is much more comfortable to you.
I mean, I've been on The Jump. More people are... Good newsflash for you. More people are watching The Jump on ESPN.
Uncle Caliente Clippers.
Basketball on ESPNU. It's not nerve-wracking from that standpoint.
So it's standing and holding a microphone?
Yeah.
Maybe you should make this bonus content. I don't know if this should be part of the podcast.
Like it gives the listener something to look for if they watch that.
It's like Russell Wilson with Rain. It'd be like, wow. Kevin Pelton is standing and holding a microphone. They found his one kryptonite. It's like that's your equivalent of Russell Wilson has been touched by rain.
Yes.
Speaking of which.
So UW women's basketball got a 65-47 win on Sunday at San Diego. They led 25-9 after one quarter and by 22 at halftime. Amber Melgoza led the way with 17 points and 5 steals in just 24 minutes of action in that comfortable victory. Huskies back home this weekend hosting the Husky Classic, facing San Francisco on Friday, and they have not gone with an official tournament format, much like the Puerto Rico Classic. I don't know what's going on with the tournaments the UW women's basketball team is in. Saturday, they will be playing Vanderbilt in what is the marquee game of that the Husky Classic without any risk of getting upset and avoiding that in the first game for those two teams. Now let's turn our attention back to Las Vegas and UW football, who will play number 18 Boise State in the Las Vegas Bowl on Saturday, 4:30 p.m. on ABC in the final game for Chris Peterson as coach of the Huskies, a game also that I will be covering while I'm in Vegas next week.
You're covering this?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I reached out and no one was covering it for ESPN, so now I am.
So you're going to be standing and holding a microphone on ABC?
I will not be on ABC.
Sideline reporting?
No time.
I know a thing or two about sideline reporting after my experience.
Look,
I've covered Agua Caliente, so I think I'm ready for this one. Like, and we send it now down to Kevin Belton on the field.
If that happens, something will have gone horribly, horribly wrong. And more things will continue to go horribly wrong.
So you're covering this one on the typing side?
I am on the typing side, yes.
Okay.
It'll be the first time I've actually journalistically covered football.
You're covering all sorts of sports this year. Really,
it up.
Branching out. You're on TV. You're covering soccer. You're covering football.
You know, I'm trying to stay versatile.
Wow. What's
next? It's a positionless league now.
Golly.
So Boise State comes into this number 25 in ESPN's Football Power Index and a 3.5 point favorites, despite being ranked 18th and the Huskies being unranked. Their lone loss came 28-25 at BYU. Boise State won four games by 7 points or fewer. They had went 12-1, but had several close calls, including an overtime home win versus Wyoming. And the best team they faced all season in terms of FPI was number 42 Air Force. So this will be a step up in competition for the Broncos, despite the fact that they did schedule to play at Florida State in their season opener.
Yeah, which it was basically like their signature game of the schedule kind of just turned out to be a bust.
Yes.
But they definitely had to, they didn't crush Florida State in that game in what was an extremely down year for Florida State. They had to fight back to win that one.
Still a good win, I think, for them.
And on the road.
Did Florida State kind of fall apart after that? I think they had some injuries, right?
That was early in the season.
So another thing that happened with Boise State that affects this is they played three quarterbacks this season after the graduation of longtime starter Brett Rypien.
At the same time?
Yeah. They were using the all-11 offense. They were taking it to the next level and using three quarterbacks instead of the two that were in the all-11 offense. And I don't know how many people are going to get that reference. True freshman Hank Buckmeyer won the job in fall camp and won all 7 of his starts before suffering a shoulder injury. Then sophomore Chase Cord took over for him when he first had a hip injury and then the shoulder injury. And he started 2 games, the loss to BYU and the overtime victory at home against Wyoming. Then the job went to senior Jalen Henderson, who has gone 4-0 as a starter, including the Mountain West Conference Championship game, and held on to the job even after Buckmeyer returned from injury. So even though I don't think they've officially said this, the expectation, understandably, is that he will start the Las Vegas Bowl. Buckmeyer was a little bit more effective in terms of yards per attempt at 9.2 to Henderson's 7.8, but the coaches really seemed to value that Henderson was turnover-free as a player through just 2 interceptions in 133 attempts, also a bit more of a running threat and was sacked way less frequently, just 6 times in the 4 games he started. His overall QBR is 79.9, which would rank 17th nationally among players with at least 100 plays, to 68.0 for Buckmeyer and 65.6 for Cord. So he's definitely been the most effective of the three quarterbacks.
Interesting.
Looking elsewhere, their running game has been pretty meh. They ranked 7th in the Mountain West in yards per carry. Strong defensively all across the board, allowing third fewest yards per carry in the Mountain West, and opponents completed a conference low 56% of their passes for 6.9 yards per attempt, which ranked 3rd. The big player to watch defensively for them is the Mountain West Conference Defensive Player of the Year, Curtis Weaver, who plays what they call the stud position, which is a stand-up linebacker or a stand-up pass rusher opposite, you know, playing kind of the opposite side in the 3-4. Effectively the same role as a 4-3 defensive end, but standing up. He has a team-high 13.5 sacks. This will be interesting to watch against a Husky offensive line that will be without Trey Adams in this game as he's decided to sit out the Huskies bowl game ahead of the NFL draft. According to the UW's depth chart that the Sports Information has put out, Jared Hilbers would move from right tackle to left tackle to replace Adams, with Henry Bainvailu listed as the starting right tackle. He had been starting at right guard in place of Jackson Kirkland, who was injured in the Colorado game, you'll recall. But Coach Pete said in the original press conference after this game was announced that he's got a really good shot to come back and play in the Las Vegas Bowl. So that would be the shift on the offensive line.
What are the other players? So we have Hunter Bryant sitting this one out.
Yes.
We have Trey Adams sitting this one out.
That's it.
Everybody else is a go.
As far as we know, 5 days away, yeah.
So, I mean, what we're talking about is for Boise State definitely playing against the best defense that they've seen all year.
Yes.
And probably by a pretty significant margin. So, I mean, you do have to sort of take, I don't want to say these stats with a grain of salt, because it's not like they're playing against, you know, the easiest opponents, but they really haven't faced anything like what this Husky defensive attack presents, especially if these players have, you know, when they're playing well.
So another interesting wild card about this game is that Boise State lost their offensive coordinator, Zach Hill, who was announced last Saturday as Arizona State's new offensive coordinator. Their co-offensive coordinator, who presumably will take over those duties, is Eric Kiesau, who
you
was...
remember him?
Yeah, I remember the name. He was UW's offensive coordinator in 2012 and 2013 under Sark. Sark was, I think, still calling the plays at that point, I'm pretty sure.
Running a lot of stuff.
So Kiesau probably didn't have the same clout as a typical offensive coordinator, and then somehow ended up the next year he was a wide receivers coach at Kansas, of all places, before getting some slightly better jobs. I'm surprised that his career hasn't had the upward trajectory that you would have expected, but that will be another shift for them. Also, Brian Harsin reportedly interviewed for the Arkansas job that subsequently got filled. Some speculation that, you know, he had a press conference after last week, after basically committing to come back, where he talked about really wanting the program to commit to, you know, being able to continue growing rather than plateauing. And, you know, kind of the speculation in the media in Boise was that it sounded similar to, like, before Dan Hawkins left for Colorado and before Coach Pete left to come to UW. So Brian Harsin, even though he's a Boise State native, Boise State alum, may not be long for that program.
When he was the head coach at Arkansas State, right?
Yes.
Before he took over as their head coach.
Yes.
So it does make sense.
There was a little bit of a geographical tie, but also Arkansas is probably, you know, you're maybe hoping for something a little better than that.
Who did they hire as their coach?
I had never heard of who they hired.
Some guy.
They sure did hire a guy. It really made national news when Arkansas hired some guy whose name. So they hired Barry Odom as defensive coordinator. And who's the defensive? Oh, Sam Pittman is their head coach.
Sam Pittman.
He was the associate head coach and offensive line coach at Georgia.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
That is a choice.
SEC decision. That makes sense, though. I mean, you know, like, Coach Pete could have stayed at Boise State for a long time and had himself a very respectable career. Brian Harsin hasn't reached the same sort of heights that Coach Pete did at Boise State and hasn't sort of earned the name recognition that Pete did. I mean, ultimately, he's probably just not as good of a coach.
And but also, I mean, you know, now, this wasn't the only period of time that Boise State broke through, but a lot of it was just having Kellen Moore. Like, if you get a generational quarterback like that, we've seen at UW, it turns out the quarterback position is very important to what you're doing.
Is the generational quarterback Jake Browning?
I didn't say that. I
was going to say, of what generation?
Most accomplished quarterback in program history.
Not every school has a player the caliber of being on the Vikings practice squad.
But Kellen Moore, it's not like he enjoyed a spectacular NFL career. He's a better offensive coordinator than he ever was a quarterback
Kellen
in the
Moore
NFL.
Kellen Moore started more games in the NFL than Jake Browning ever will.
That's likely true. But I think there's some broad similarities between Jake Browning and Kellen Moore in terms of better college than pro quarterbacks. But I don't know. The fact that Hank Buckmeyer was as effective as he was as a true freshman is kind of impressive. Like, I think long-term, they're in probably pretty good hands if he can develop into that job, even though he lost it at the end of this year to Henderson, who's much more experienced in the system.
Okay, so our expectation for this, we know that Boise State is playing against a defense better than they've seen all year. Maybe not. We have no idea really what to expect on offense. What do we expect in general from this game, though? Because this is the best opponent that Boise State has played all season by a pretty significant margin across the board, offense, defense, special teams.
I mean, I don't know about across the boards. I don't know if it's the best offense they've faced. I mean, my expectation is this is going to be a low-scoring game. Because, I mean, maybe not to the extremes of the Oregon State game, but I think in that ballpark, in terms of both defenses really stifling what the other offense wants to do. Because,
really?
You know, I'm very concerned about Curtis Weaver defensively and the havoc he can wreak playing against offensive line without Trey Adams. And, like, by this point, we know what the case is with Dr. Eason and Mr. Hyde. If he gets pressured, he will be wildly ineffective. If he doesn't, he will be good. And I think he will get pressure.
Do we think that the Huskies will be able to run the ball in this game?
Okay. I think they'll be able to run fine.
I don't know. Okay, let me ask you a question. Do you care about this game at all?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that, so for one, I was obviously like biased that I was definitely hoping the Huskies ended up in the Vegas Bowl because of the fact that I was already going to be there. Extremely convenient.
They fly the sideline reporters wherever the game is. You don't have to be there already.
Well, you know, they could have played a game that ESPN wasn't covering.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You didn't even consider that, did you? I think that I love the story of Coach Pete going against Boise State in his final game as much as he may hate that. I mean, that's obviously going to be the dominant national storyline out of this game. And, you know,
tell me how many national storylines are coming out of the Las Vegas Bowl.
Just this one. That's the one.
It'll be an afterthought on SportsCenter.
It'll be mentioned. They'll probably show the Jared Zabransky, or the Ian Johnson, I guess it is, on the Statue of Liberty play from the Fiesta Bowl. That'll probably be shown.
They have to show it.
What's the over-under on the number of times that comes up on the broadcast?
Running a trick play still haunts Chris Peterson.
To this day.
the greatest irony that he'll have ever known is that he'll forever be known as a trick play coach.
They did try that one Aaron Fuller pass at Colorado.
Never again. It'd be like if Pete, like, okay.
What if he comes out in his final game and it's just like trick plays all the time?
Let's say that Pete Carroll, this is a hypothetical scenario. Pete Carroll, CX go to the Super Bowl this year and they pick up this crazy fourth down, right? Like Pete Carroll goes for it. It's like.
You can't say that while I'm drinking.
Fourth and 10 from like their own 38 or something, and they pick up this insane fourth down, and that's what Pete Carroll is known for forever.
I mean, is he, you know, this came up last week in this conversation, or 2 weeks ago maybe, whenever it was, he used to be known as Big Balls Pete. They went for it all the time at USC. It was like one of the most notable things about him. So
it's really easy.
People change as they age.
When you're up 51-7 against Cal, it's really easy to go for it.
Sometimes you're down 51-7 to Stanford. What's your deal? All right, what were you talking about? Oh, do I care about this game? No, I mean, the other thing is, you know, the Huskies, they've been very consistent at getting two bowl games over a long period of time.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that tomorrow in the decade in review. I'm going to save it for that. But very consistent at getting to bowl games. You know what they haven't been very consistent at?
What is that?
Winning bowl games.
Yes.
Because the only Coach Pete bowl win is...
Zaxby's
Heart of Dallas Bowl against Southern Miss. So,
who sponsors the Las Vegas Bowl?
Boy, I don't know that off the top of my head. I better learn that before I'm on the sidelines. I'm going to need to know that information.
It's definitely sponsored by like Sunbasket. So in the Sunbasket Las Vegas Bowl.
It is the Mitsubishi Motors Las Vegas Bowl.
That's actually a bigger sponsor than I was anticipating.
Well, clearly it's bigger than Sunbasket, yes. Well, by the way, get at us.
We're available.
We're not available. So, and I think it also, you know, a nice capper to the Coach Pete era, and then just a good way to go into the Jimmy Lake era, which, by the way, I didn't put this in the notes for some reason. Jimmy Lake got his first victory as Husky head coach last weekend.
What was that?
Getting Jacob or Jacoby, I don't know if we still haven't figured out how his name is pronounced, Covington.
Jacobé.
To recommit after he decommitted a 4-star cornerback from Arizona.
Cornerback?
Yeah.
Like, why would you decommit when Jimmy Lake's going to be the head coach?
Well, he didn't decommit after that. He decommitted before the coaching change.
Oh, so this was before the coaching change.
Yeah.
Oh.
And they just kind of went back and re-recruited him and won him back. Arizona State was making a big push for him as a hometown guy, basically. Mm-hmm. And UW went and got him from the same high school that Byron Murphy went to.
Can I just say, a little fired up about the Jimmy Lake era?
Who's not getting a little fired up about the Jimmy Lake
right?
era? I mean, we're probably getting a little too fired up about the Jimmy Lake era.
The frustrating thing is, like, you know with every coach that you're going to love some things and hate some things. And, like, in the end, you'll probably not end up liking them that much because that's just, like, the state of coaching, basically. There's no coach who has 100% approval rating. And every decision that you agree with and everything they do, you agree with.
That's true. I mean, one of the important things I learned in my life a long time ago was that I had to stop evaluating coaches by whether I agreed with what they did, because I realized that the only coach I would like would be myself then. Because No one's ever going to agree with me 100% of the time. And a lot of those times I'm going to be wrong. So that would be a better coach. Oh, probably so. But it's
so
also,
you don't evaluate coaches based upon whether you agree with them. How would you evaluate a coach?
I don't.
This will transition to the next conversation.
Well, this is a strange conversation after a big win.
Can you evaluate a coach based upon...
I'm not saying that's not a factor, but it can't be like, oh, this coach didn't do exactly what I would do, therefore I dislike them.
Uh-huh.
It's got to be, what is the average coach? How often do I agree with the average coach, and how often do I agree with this coach? And sometimes there are some other things you have to quantify.
It's a really tough thing because you can't exactly agree with a scheme necessarily.
Right.
It's like, I agree with Sean McVay's offense.
But you also can't agree with setting a cohesive, like, vision for the organization or program. And that's a really important thing.
Yeah, I think it is a very complicated thing to judge.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I agree with Coach Pete's general Coach Pete-ness. You know what I mean? Like, I just agree with the tone that Coach Pete sets in a lot of ways. But also, I'm pretty fired up about the difference between Coach Pete and Jimmy Lake. Seems like Jimmy Lake, this is all always, seems like it's a cycle, though. Every new coach comes in, especially when the previous coach is a little bit more old school or whatever, and they want to be a little bit more public, a little bit more on social media or whatever. And then all of a sudden, something will go wrong and they'll close practices for everybody or whatever. It's just like, it's the same.
Yeah.
We haven't seen Jimmy Lake.
Well, people get more conservative as they get older. Again.
But it's not even that. Didn't Coach Sark literally, like, shut down practice for press? I'm pretty sure that happened at some point. It was just like all of a sudden they lost a game, but things got a little bit harder than you thought. And Coach Sark wasn't quite as progressive. He wasn't as much on whatever the social media was of the time. You know, he wasn't posting on MySpace as much as he was before.
It was Twitter or whatever. That long ago that Sark was here.
Still somehow sending a lot of DMs.
Oh, no.
Just an inordinate amount. But you understand what I'm saying. It's like Jimmy, everything is we're in the honeymoon period with Jimmy. Like,
yeah.
Everything he does is great.
Of course.
But at the same time, I'm getting a little fired up about it.
Yeah. We're in the honeymoon period. I mean,
yeah.
I'm going to enjoy it because eventually those fights over the toothpaste are going to add up. And all of a sudden, you want the coach fired, even though you're 11-3.
All you can see from a victory in Carolina is that they made one bad fourth down decision.
Maybe a little more than that.
Percentage chances of victory for UW in the Sun Basket Las Vegas Bowl.
I don't love this matchup for the Huskies.
Really?
I think they're the better team, but I don't think they match up well. And I don't know. It'll be interesting to see motivation because Boise State has had a better season. Feels like, but also going to the Vegas Bowl was much more like, oh, we're going here again. Whereas the Coach Pete element probably does help UW
finally
motivation.
Win a bowl game we can win.
But I say 45% chance of it.
You're way off here. Your whole feel for
really?
This is totally wrong.
Wow, I hope so.
I feel like we haven't disagreed this much about a game. I'm telling you right now, this is not even going to be a close game.
Wow.
Like,
That is a bold prediction.
These are not equal teams playing a football game.
The Huskies are 6 or 7 spots higher in Football Power Index. It's not like they're playing, you know, Idaho in this game.
But also, just all of the other factors. Coach Pete ain't losing this one to Boise State. Right? Like, Coach Pete is not going to coach his last ever game against his former team and fucking lose. Right? This is not the Raiders Oakland.
Is he going to bring Kellen Moore in at quarterback then?
He is going to do whatever he can to win this game and whatever he can do in the ironic situation of Coach Peterson. Chris Peterson is not run trick plays. He's just going to out-process them.
Nice.
He's going to have his team prepared to play this game.
He's going
to
out-OKG them.
He is going to OK the G in this game. And the Huskies are going to, they'll win this game. They'll be up by 2 touchdowns basically the whole game. It'll be a game where maybe in the end the score gets a little bit closer, but it's just like they're gonna long arm the entire game. The Huskies are winning this game by 10 plus points.
I really need that. That expression needs to catch on, like keeping the arm's length in a team. It's a really useful expression.
Sometimes you arm's length the team, and then all of a sudden they might have a possession at the end
of the game. Oh.
And all of a sudden Kyle Allen starts seeming pretty scary.
I guess we're transitioning now to talking about the Seahawks.
I didn't even give a percent.
I just guaranteed victory.
I had 65 points in my head, but I'm...
You talked yourself into a higher percentage with that speech.
It's 70 plus. Okay. 70%, 72% chance. They're just not losing this game. I'm sorry. They are not losing this game.
Except 28% of the time they are. 72% of the time it works every time. I'm not going to lie to you. That smells like pure gasoline. So now we'll transition to the Seahawks, who coming off a 30-24 win Sunday at Carolina are now the number one seed in the NFC. As of today, which is meaningful because the season ends today. It doesn't end today. I'm getting that over my earpiece.
I almost hate... You're just practicing for TV.
Yeah.
You've got an earpiece. Yeah. I kind of hate being the number one seed as of today.
Do you? I prefer it, I gotta say.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I prefer being number one in the NFC West.
I mean, I would prefer it if we had like a 2-game lead or something, but just the possibilities of being hoisted on your own petard are so high.
Let's Seahawks Twitter. We talked a couple weeks ago about how entering the Rams game, I thought that Seahawks Twitter was due for a letdown.
Do we think Seahawks Twitter is getting out of control? Do you?
Again, there's a lot of disrespect talk on Seahawks Twitter Monday. A lot of disrespect
talk. Define Seahawks Twitter.
Okay, I mean, there's a number of different corners of Seahawks Twitter. We are part of self-loathing Seahawks Twitter.
That is, that's all you need. I just think whatever part you're talking about, then...
I mean, it includes some pretty prominent voices in Seahawks Twitter. Let's put it that way.
I don't like the overconfidence. And it's just like, so what? You're in the number one seed today. It doesn't matter. Be in the number one seed at the end of week 17. I mean, the good thing about it is...
I mean, a lot of Seahawks Twitter is acting like they're Kumail Nanjiani, and they suddenly are secretly jacked.
I have not seen this most recent season.
No, you haven't seen this on Twitter?
On Silicon
it's
Valley?
It's not a Silicon Valley reference.
Oh, Kumail Nanjiani's just secretly jacked?
He bulked up for a superhero movie. How did you miss this?
Was it that movie with the wrestler?
It's something with the erasers? Is that it? It's something in that ballpark.
But yeah. Anyway. It has, what's his name? Do we just know media?
Oh, yeah. That's
you know
us.
What I mean? And just a finger on the pulse.
I was waiting this entire pod to get in a Kumail Nanjiani jacked reference. And you just, nothing. I mean, definitely Seahawks Twitter was in on this, I'm sure. So maybe you just were sitting this one out.
No, it was Marvel's Eternals.
Oh, Eternals, okay.
So it was not for the movie that came out over the summer.
No, it's forthcoming, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But did you find the photos yet?
So he didn't...
No, you can't be looking at this. You got to go Kumail Nanjiani jacked.
He didn't get jacked for The Big Sick. Stuber was what I was thinking of as the movie.
Well, he couldn't get jacked for The Big Sick because he wasn't jacked in real life at that point.
With Dave Bautista. So I should be searching Kumail Nanjiani jacked.
I don't know why that's pumped and jacked, maybe.
Pumped and jacked?
No, that's Pete Carroll. I'm, I'm, I'm just joking there.
Oh my.
That's quite something, isn't it?
I don't know if I like this Kumail Nanjiani. He's almost Derek. This looks photoshopped.
It does. But I don't think it is. It's not April 1st. It's not April Fool's Day.
I'm going to need to collect my thoughts here.
Oh, and take a moment.
Can you still, I don't know, can you still be funny if you're that jacked?
I was going to say Carrot Top, but Carrot Top probably wasn't funny in the first place.
Fine, funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. What were we talking about?
Seahawks being number one at the NFC.
I don't care about where you are today. I care about where you are today in as much as that the tiebreakers matter. But well, when there are still games left to play, I just don't care. I literally do not care.
I mean, there are two things that are relevant out of what happened on Sunday. Number one is the very slim outside possibility that the Seahawks could win the NFC West without beating the 49ers. A possibility that became even slimmer and even outsider with the Saints dominating the Colts on Monday Night Football earlier. But it still exists. There's a path to it. It's just very remote. And that would be great. I'm
because
all for
the
that
common
scenario.
Opponents thing was hurt by the Saints winning that game.
Yes. It was much more likely had the 49ers lost to the Saints and then beat the Falcons last weekend instead of the other way around, because then they would have a much weaker win over Atlanta rather than the stronger win over New Orleans. The other thing is that all of a sudden, the Seahawks can lose to the Cardinals this weekend. And I mean, it still matters in terms of seeding and everything, but it does not prevent them from winning the NFC West. So the Cardinals are not going to spoil Christmas this year.
They still might, but
not in the same way. I put down here recent Seahawks December games against the Cardinals. God. 2018, the Seahawks won their finale against the Cardinals, but it was by a 27-24 margin.
Just a brute. I don't really remember that game, and I choose not to.
In 2017, Christmas Eve was ruined, or New Year's Eve, I should say, was ruined by
the Cardinals.
We were
already in the playoffs, it didn't matter, but yes.
With their 26-24 win in Bruce Arians' final game as head coach. In 2016, Christmas Eve was ruined by the Cardinals with their 34-31 win. In 2013, it was December 22nd that they beat the Seahawks 17-10.
Which I still remember, this is my rosebud of Seahawks games. Right? It's like there's like Oregon State Husky football in like 2007 or something. Where I was
wait,
like,
the really rainy one or the Isaiah Stanback injury one?
I think those were the exact same game.
No, there was two different ones because there was one where you were living at the house in Wedgewood.
In Wedgewood. Yeah, that's the one that I'm really thinking of.
Okay.
The Isaiah Stanback injury one, though, was a close second. And that's just like...
Because I was at the Isaiah Stanback injury game, but the Wedgewood one, I dropped you and the famous Cousin Katie off the stadium, but did not attend the game.
You made a good decision.
I did.
Of up there with some of the worst football games I've ever been to. And I like this game in 2013, we're going on nigh a decade since it happened.
Also, the Seahawks won the fucking Super Bowl that year.
It does the memories the memories of that loss still weigh heavier on me than the memories of the Super Bowl victory, because they matter more in this very moment than winning a Super Bowl from a decade ago, because that is what this weekend is going to look like for me. They're not going to be beating the Broncos in the Super Bowl. Peyton Manning ain't walking through that door, but the goddamn Cardinals are at the end of December, and it's going to be wet, and it's going to be ugly in Seattle.
All right, but we're going to talk about that in a bit. We've still got more to get to in our topics. Do we want to talk any more about the playoff picture? The Seahawks just need to keep winning games.
That's it.
I highly recommend it. It does seem likely that Week 17 against the 49ers will now be played in prime time.
When are they going to announce that?
So they have up until, I believe, the Monday before to make that announcement. In practice, I went and looked this up because we were discussing it on Twitter. They have always announced it during the Sunday night game the week before. So they'd announce it before the Minnesota-Green Bay game, which could affect the chances of the Seahawks clinching ahead of that game. But I think the chances are remote, and B, it's a chance that NBC would take because you just want to be able to promote the upcoming game on next week's broadcast.
Minnesota-Green Bay game when?
They play on Monday Night Football on December 23rd. So,
but it would be NBC announcing this?
Yes.
During the Bears-Chiefs game?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think they will very likely announce Seahawks 49ers.
it would be pretty surprising to announce anything else.
Yeah, third Pelton brother Zach Whitman went through it, and you know, there's not a lot of other interesting games where both teams are in the playoffs, and it doesn't affect anything else.
But also, just even as a game to watch, like, people care about this football game.
Oh, for sure.
That game is all that matters.
It's not all that matters.
If the Seahawks,
it's the most important thing.
If the Seahawks win out, here's a question for you about seeding. They clinch the number one seed in the NFC.
It depends whether Green Bay also wins out. Or New Orleans. So if the Seahawks and New Orleans are tied at 13-3, then New Orleans would win that tie by virtue of having won in Seattle.
So we're actually cheering for Green Bay being part of this tiebreaker.
Yeah, that's why the Seahawks are currently number one, is because it's a three-team tie with Green Bay in New Orleans, and that one is then settled by conference record, I believe, which favors the Seahawks and Green Bay over New Orleans. Don't ask me to explain all of this, but that's my understanding of it.
Okay. Well, really, all that matters.
Look, the thing is, shit's going to happen because exactly. You know what we weren't thinking last Saturday or even last Sunday or even after that fumble was recovered at the 1 yard line by the 49ers? We weren't thinking, hey, the 49ers are going to lose at home to the Falcons. And then it happened.
Yes. That's why I hate talking through these scenarios. Like, we've talked so much about the scenario of if the 49ers lose and the Seahawks win, what does it mean? I'm just like, let's just see.
I mean, that was Pete Carroll's attitude this morning, which I think is understandable for a coach at this point. Like, it doesn't affect
he's going to coach to win the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also like, it's not like a scenario where like, oh, it's okay if we lose. It's still, they need to win. That nothing changes from his standpoint. They still need to win the fucking game.
he's gonna coach for the 49ers
well, to lose. You know, he might coach for his team to lose sometimes, but that's a separate issue. Again, we're going to get to this. It's Seahawks.
Playoff seed, being the number one seed right now is great, and it's really nice that there is a tiebreaker that makes sense for all these teams. Minnesota will probably beat the Packers and fuck that up completely. Just like, there's so much that, there's only two more weeks of football, but so much crazy shit is going to happen over these next 2 weeks.
Yep. So the Seahawks finished 7-1 on their road with their win Sunday in Carolina. 4-0 in 10 a.m. road games or 5-0 in 10 a.m. road games? Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Carolina. Was there one other one?
That seems like all of them.
Okay. That's good.
Because the other road games would have been...
At LA, at San Francisco, games. At Arizona.
All were late.
And there's one other game we're missing here.
Yep.
Atlanta.
That
so
was 10. Five,
so they were 5-0 in 10 a.m. games. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
And sort of the talk has been that home field advantage doesn't mean what it used to mean, especially this year in particular in the NFL.
I mean, I don't know that I would read too much in season-to-season variation, but there is a long-term trend in all sports that I've seen studied towards less home field advantage over time. So it makes sense.
Why? Because to me, when I heard this, I was just like, this is just a random anomaly. But you're telling me this is an actual trend.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and it's across sports.
We wrote about it at ESPN. It was Tom Haberstroh and Steve Ilardi like 4 or 5 years ago about how home court advantage was on the decline. And at that point, that season, I think it was like 14-15, would have been the lowest home court advantage on record, basically. And again, it's similar across sports.
Why?
So I think the prevailing theory is, you know, well, there's a variety of factors that go into home field or home court advantage. The number one factor is Scorecasting did some great work on this, appears to be the effect of the home crowd on refereeing. And, you know, I think there's probably two factors at play here. Number one, leagues have been working much more to take that bias out of officiating and replay in particular. You know, now all of a sudden it's not, the call is not necessarily in the hands of referees who are being influenced by the crowd, but oftentimes by New York and whether they decide that Dak Prescott said defer or not.
That was a home crowd.
I know. And then number two, probably the fact that the existence of secondary markets for selling tickets has made it much more likely for road fans to be at games.
You think, I just don't believe that as a factor.
I mean, I don't think that's nearly as significant as the officiating changes and the league changes, but I think it probably is a factor.
Well, so you said cross sport, because I was curious how much you thought, like, having headsets in the helmets for quarterbacks Like, there's no issue, like, getting calls. I mean, that's
been true for a long time.
And relaying calls. But so that's not a factor.
And, like, people will cite travel. And, yeah, teams are probably getting, you know, wiser about how they travel. But they've been traveling by charter for a long period of time here. That's not new.
Do you think that the abundance of replay in basically every sport has meant that officials are even more on it to call things more neutral?
To an extent, but also when they don't call it that way, it's more likely that it'll get changed.
Yeah.
So...
So it could be in the past one major call swung the home team's way or whatever, which could swing the outcome of an entire game.
Yeah. I mean, now the interesting question here from a Seahawks perspective is they've been better on the road than at home this season. Russell Wilson, we talked about this earlier, performs way better when he's playing in sunshine, in clear conditions, and is not touched by rain. Should the Seahawks play any home games that they do get in a neutral city?
Now, is that possible?
I don't know if there are any rules against it. I feel like they have the choice of playing the game wherever they want. Like, I nominated Carolina. You lamented the 2015 playoffs, but I feel like there's a lot of good memories for the Seahawks in Carolina. They won a lot of games there. Weather's
is
pretty good.
Is it the only game that they lost in Carolina in the Russell Wilson era?
I think so.
Is that the only game that they've lost to Carolina in the Russell Wilson? We talked last week about how many times they played Carolina.
That might be. I can't remember.
I don't remember any other losses
off the top of my head, so I can't rule it out. We'll have to fill here where I
Russell Wilson kind of owns Carolina.
He really does.
We seem to go there pretty much every year.
People don't talk about it as a revenge thing, but you know, he's going back to where he played college ball, and you know, he's got some roots
there.
I'm
sure that it's not a revenge thing.
It's not a revenge thing, but yes, that is their only loss. No, they did lose one regular season game in 2015 at home. They lost to Carolina. 27-23, yes. What was that game? Greg Olsen caught a touchdown pass with 32 seconds left. That was the game that...
I kind of remember this.
There was a couple of breakdowns in the secondary, and Richard Sherman was yelling at people on the sidelines.
That could have been a game.
Well, a notable game where it happened. I think that was that one.
Okay.
So anyways, either that or build the dome in time for the playoffs.
Great.
Build the roof.
Just pray for good weather.
We've gotten this far without talking about the biggest Seahawks news of the day, which is Josh Gordon's indefinite suspension for the violation of the NFL's policies on performance-enhancing drugs, substances, and substances of abuse. So this sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a bummer for Josh Gordon. I would be upset about seeing the story no matter what team he was on.
Agreed.
Seahawks, Patriots, whomever. So
maybe a little less if it was the Patriots, but Browns for sure.
But no, even then, like I'm not, Josh Gordon didn't really matter to the Seahawks on the field all that much. I'm like, my priors are not changed all that much by Josh Gordon being out there or not being out there. You know, it's like it would have been fun to have seen him do more in this offense, but he still was catching about one pass per game.
If this is it for Josh Gordon, it's a fascinating Seahawks career. He played 5 games in a Seahawks uniform.
Hester-like.
He caught 7 passes. He threw 1 interception. Was not great. They were all like big catches, though. They have a lot of third down catches.
Did he have a catch that wasn't for a first down?
That's an interesting question.
I think every single catch as a Seahawk was for a first down.
All right, again, it's going to take me a second to look this up, but I have to scroll past the passing plays section of Josh Gordon's. That one was decidedly not for a first down. Okay, here. Let's see, 3rd and 4, 10 yards. That was a first down. 3rd and 7, 10 yards, first down. He had an 11-yard catch on 2nd and 13 against the Rams that just was after a penalty, and it made an unmakeable third down that they eventually picked up but was not a first down. So that was the only one.
Ugh, that Rams game ruined everything.
It really did.
But I think Josh Gordon, just his strange career in general, somebody who clearly had a lot of talent, was capable, if he could have avoided the substance issues, potentially been the best wide receiver in the NFL. Maybe was for half a season with the Browns.
I mean, there was a lot of people talking about getting Josh Gordon help and that sort of thing. And look, obviously, it's a condition of his employment in the NFL to not, and we don't know specifically what this.
That's what I was going to say. Everybody was jumping to a conclusion here. It's like, it's, I understand it's the most obvious conclusion, but there wasn't, the NFL didn't release.
No, we'll see if that gets leaked in the future. But it, I think if you go to the, you know, the most likely outcome, given his track record, given the relative common, you know, availability of these drugs, the odds are it's most likely weed. But I thought it was an interesting timing because just last week, baseball announced that they will no longer be testing for weed. That it's basically going to be tacitly encouraged, not encouraged, but allowed by the league. Is in accordance with them starting to test on a regular basis for opioids and cocaine, which previously, like marijuana, they only tested for if there was probable cause, although they did test for marijuana at the minor league level and suspended players for that. So that's like a very shockingly progressive stance from baseball. But this is a drug that is legal in a great many states, including Washington.
And will only become legal in more and more states. This is a, let's say that these suspensions are for weed. The issue to me is,
well, I mean, we know that many of them were.
Josh Gordon, because of his history not being able to use it, that's probably a bigger issue than the actual, I'm quoting when I say drug itself, right? But in general, for the NFL, for any sports league, this is a regressive policy.
Yeah.
And like
the outdated policy.
The idea that Josh Gordon's career could be derailed from smoking weed, it's just like, it's an absurd idea.
Especially in the NFL, when you contrast the deleterious effects of weed with the other potential painkillers that are being used by NFL players to deal with the fact that, you know, the sport is so violent by its very nature, I think it's especially problematic for the NFL to have it be banned.
When the frustrating thing about this is that he has this reputation now as like, I don't want to say that people think he's like a bad guy or whatever, but like,
I mean, as we went into in the emergency pod, or I guess the post-emergency pod, there are some more serious incidents on Josh Gordon's ledger. Yeah, it's not just smoking weed and getting suspended for it, but that is the bulk of his history.
But it's just, the whole thing is frustrating that him doing something that is legal in the state that he's playing football in,
that so many of the fans watching the games, I don't know if they're necessarily smoking in the stadium, but you know.
Could
certainly
be, though,
on a regular basis.
Right outside the stadium.
For sure.
I mean, it's not, I would say that on the health scale, probably more healthy than drinking. And a good portion of the fans in those football games are drinking extremely heavily in the game.
That's another issue altogether. But yes.
So I think the whole thing is pretty ridiculous for Josh Gordon. But at the same time, like, I think the personality-wise, of going through this again and again and again, it's like, you know, you're getting caught, right? Like, you're not sneaking one past the NFL here. And that's where it's just like, it
sucks.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to play within the rules of the system that you're in, even if the rules are ridiculous.
Well said. I think from a football standpoint, I hope this doesn't mean more David Moore.
All David Moore. John Brown's still on this team, right? I saw him catch a pass.
John Ursua was active last week. I don't believe he got any snaps in the game, but he was definitely active. But you know who was really good in this game after a down game against the Rams, kind of threw people off the scent? Malik Turner. Malik Turner, he didn't do nothing wrong, as it turns out. He did some things wrong, but 3 catches for 26 yards on 3 targets in this one. And I would like to see him be the player who steps up in the absence of Josh Gordon. He was tied for second on the team with those 3 catches, third with 4 targets, or 3 targets behind DK Metcalf. And by the way, Tyler Lockett's back, y'all.
Oh my God.
And not a moment. Well, can I tell you the fantasy story? This wouldn't have ultimately mattered, but you're welcome. Because after continuing to play Tyler Lockett through his injury-related and illness-related slump, I benched Tyler Lockett for my game against the famous Cousin Katie last week in the semifinals for Adam Thielen, who had 3 points.
Sounds like Katie's more welcome than I'm welcome.
True. And then Tyler Lockett has 120 yards and a touchdown.
Whew. But it's so exciting to see Tyler Lockett be a factor again.
The offense is just totally different with Tyler Lockett.
Being a factor on plays that break down, him communicating with Russell Wilson, so exciting to see. Being a factor on deep passes, like the ball that he caught the first deep pass was just like clearly incomplete from what I saw. And somehow he comes down. I'm like, oh, that was intercepted.
And then yeah, it went through the defender's hands, which I don't know that Tyler Lockett himself could control, but somehow it always
seems a lot of receivers are not catching that pass.
Yeah.
And Tyler Lockett did. And then the touchdown that he scored, which was probably the last great play of the game.
Well, no, it wasn't the last play of the game, because the last great play of the game was picking up the 3rd and 11.
And
after
that was a huge
eighth
one.
Consecutive holding penalty on the Seahawks offensive line.
It is communication with Russell Wilson outside the pocket, which they love to talk about on broadcast, but it's real.
It is. It's real and it's spectacular.
I do think that Malik Turner, there's something there.
I agree.
We could be getting Malik Turner more receptions, and I think in Josh Gordon's absence, him being on the field more would be the way to do it.
Should we go through the injury updates from this week?
I want to do injury updates, and I also want to talk about, after that, waiver wire players.
For fantasy? Or for the Seahawks?
Yeah, yeah. I want to go through fantasy waivers right now with you.
There's only one player that they tried to claim off waivers, and that's actually going to come up in the Cardinals section.
There were two waivers players, but I just want to talk about them.
All right, okay. Bobby Wagner, Pete Carroll said on Monday that he's going to try to ignore this sprained ankle that knocked him out of the Carolina game. It looked extremely frightening when he went down. It looked like his knee, you know, kind of buckled under him, but fortunately nothing, no damage there.
So should I sign Patrick Laird?
Miles Gaskin was in the game a lot on Sunday we saw in red zone.
Rashad Perryman's available in that league.
The Seahawks defense was very different, as it turned out, with Bobby Wagner unavailable. A large factor in Carolina making this a one-score game.
Do we think that that's the case, or is it their defense where they're in this soft zone?
I think there was elements of both. Also, they had like 6 starters out by that point. But I think also that Wagner in particular was maybe the most irreplaceable of those starters, even ahead of Quandre Diggs, who suffered a high ankle sprain in this game, and it sounds like, according to Pete Carroll, could be longer for him. I think you'd hope at this point to get him back for the San Francisco game.
Yes.
Lano Hill came in for him with Bradley McDougald moving to free safety.
Is Marquise Blair on IR?
No. Okay. They just chose Lano Hill over him. Michael Kendricks missed the game with a hamstring injury.
His second in a row.
Yeah. Carroll said, we think he is going to will his way back out there in time for this Sunday's game. Again, it seems like probably the focus should be on the San Francisco game, especially the way Arizona plays, because you're not going to want to play a lot of base defense against the Cardinals.
Welcome to Pete Carroll. No. Maybe you're not going to want to play a lot of base defense against the Cardinals, but you don't judge coaches by what you would do.
That's a great point. Hey, look, there were some important nickel moments in this game. Shouts to Ugo Amadi in that return on what wasn't a fumble, but could have been. Shaquille Griffin, kind of a surprise that he missed the game. Also a hamstring situation, right? Hamstring?
Sure.
Not going to know until the end of the week on him, Pete Carroll said. Akeem King did a pretty good job, I would say, in his place.
Really was not noticeable in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Ezekiel Ansah, who missed his second consecutive game since suffering a snare, counting on him to have a really good chance to come back, Pete Carroll said Monday. And then Jadeveon Clowney, who missed this one, he was ruled out on Friday because of the fact, not because of the core muscle issue he's been dealing with, but because he had the flu. And Pete Carroll said, we couldn't put him on the plane because he was violently ill. And in no situations do you want the words violently and ill to be together.
And on a plane.
No, none of those words do you want to do that.
Yeah, we're talking end of times type situation when you throw a plane into the mix.
Hoping I'm not violently ill on either my flight to Las Vegas or back.
Well, you never know.
Can't rule it out.
After being in this house. Yeah. The Jadeveon Clowney situation was really strange because it, like the quotes, I think this was Thursday during the day, Thursday or Friday during the day, were like,
oh, he's probably going to gut it out, yeah.
it was like, it seemed like he was sort of over the injury. And then all of a sudden it was just, Jadeveon's out. And it was really because they were getting on the plane and he wasn't getting on the plane.
Yeah, that was why. Yeah, that's simple.
It was all of a sudden he's out. And it was kind of shocking. But I mean, in hindsight, a lot of players missed this game. Kyle Allen is a really bad quarterback.
He might have also missed the game.
Like,
the Seahawks didn't get much pressure without either Ansah or Clowney. Rasheem Green had their only sack, but it was fine.
If you had to have five starters miss a game, and hopefully I'm going to do a giant knock on wood here, these are not season-ending injuries.
It seems unlikely.
For most, if not everybody, depending on how long the season goes, this was the game that you'd want them to miss.
Yeah.
And if a player like Quandre Diggs, we are assuming he's not going to be back this week.
Seems unlikely.
The Bobby Wagner thing to me, they need to beat the Cardinals.
I mean, I think Wagner can probably play through the game without a significant chance of re-injury.
That's the question. It's like, is there anything that will happen this week against the Cardinals that, because the game against the 49ers is more important whether you win or lose.
It's paramount.
So whatever you can do to be healthy against the 49ers is what you do. Mm-hmm. So if there's any risk for re-injury, don't play against the Cardinals.
So you want to complain about Pete Carroll now?
Well, can we walk through the situation with their... I want to bring up the exact situation.
Took two timeouts on fourth down decisions, which is not great. One of them was a challenge.
He challenged
them. Yeah, I mean, it had some upside of maybe they would win the challenge.
He did not technically take a timeout in the second one.
Yes, but effectively, he took a timeout. So the first one, they were facing fourth and one at the Carolina 12-yard line with 32 seconds left
down
in
10.
The first half. Down 10.
Or up 10, sorry.
Or 32 seconds, I should say, left in the third quarter. And yes, they were down at that point. They were up at that point, 10, yes.
This was up there with the worst coaching decisions that Pete Carroll's made all season. And they hit the field goal, but the difference between 10 and 13 is just not that great. Like, your percentage chances of victory don't change all that much between these two scores. And it's like, if they were to score a touchdown there and go up 17, the game's over.
Well, the game would not have been over, as it turned out.
Up 17, though, it would have been a lot closer. If they have throw four more points into the mix, and what's the difference?
Yeah, you know they were up 30 to 10 in this game.
Right? But if they would have been up 34 to 10, it would have been a very different situation.
Okay, but you can't say the game is over when they're up 17. If the game wasn't over, they're up 20 with less time remaining. Those don't mix.
Shut up. What I'm saying...
Yes, I understand what you're saying. It doesn't become it doesn't change the number of scores by which you're leading. And so it's less valuable, and it's a 1 yard situation. It was probably closer to 2 on this one.
Was it that much closer to 2? Here's what I'm saying.
I mean, the other one was 1 foot. It was literally 1 fucking foot.
In this, but they never measure it that way. They never place
the
ball
as close
as you want
them to. No, I think
they did
place it that close.
What didn't fucking matter? Because they got way more yards when they went for it on the second fourth down. They blew past the first
down
and scored a touchdown. And if Chris Carson could have gotten a foot, you could have gotten 2 yards.
I don't know if I would treat that as a consistent outcome of the Seahawks on short yardage situations for them.
They actually did quite well in short yardage in this game. Sometimes there was maybe one that was a little bit questionable. There was a spot that they called a first down where I was not so sure about it. But this is the kind of decision. We're not worried about the Carolina game. You're playing against Kyle Allen. Whatever. This is the kind of decision that is going to affect you when you're playing against teams like San Francisco, like the teams that you'll be meeting in the playoffs. You cannot make this same decision.
And you especially can't take a timeout to kick the fucking field goal.
That's the other thing where it's like, it is a doubly, it's the decision to kick the field goal in general is bad, but just take the delay of game if you're going to kick the field goal. 5 yards doesn't matter that much. If you're going to pay Jason Myers this much money to be your kicker, he can hit that field goal from 5 yards back.
Oh, you can't. No, not so much on the extra points.
This is the kind of decision that loses you high impact games.
Yeah.
And that's why it's an issue. This is a process issue. It didn't matter in this game against Carolina in the end, although it did get a lot closer than it should have in the end.
I mean, here's the thing is, it doesn't matter what we say. It's not going to change. I guess the one hope is that now that the Seahawks have the successful example of going for fourth down and scoring a touchdown off of it.
Pete Carroll's philosophy after 74 years of living will change.
But I think
had that one successful fourth down.
The New Orleans game where they didn't get it did seem to make him more conservative this year than he's been in the past. So I think these things irrationally matter.
Why the timeout, though?
I mean, I guess
there's no logic to the process.
But that's the point, is because of the fact that you don't have a defined process for this is when we're going to go and this is when we're not, it's going to take too long to take that. To make that decision.
It's all knee-jerk. It's just whatever he's feeling in that moment.
It's gut.
Yeah. He's going with his gut, and his gut tells him that 13-point lead will be just great. And I understand that the Seahawks went into Carolina and won, but they also were facing a very bad quarterback. Like, look,
the team that fired its coach 2 weeks earlier.
The 49ers lost to the Falcons later in the day.
Oh, man. By the way, I didn't say this earlier, but in related to our discussion of the Cardinals situation, what a Seahawksy loss for the 49ers to beat the Saints on the road and then come home and lose to the Falcons. That is so Seahawksy. The only way it could have been more Seahawksy is if Jimmy Garoppolo were missing all those throws because it was raining.
Oh, yeah. No, here's one more thing you'd have to throw into the mix for a Seahawks loss. This is maybe 2017, is they get the ball down 7 or 8 with 43 seconds left and no timeouts, and then he throws a pick to end the game. Like, that would have been...
Ultimate Seahawks.
Yeah, you just have to... The Seahawks have never had the situation where they gave up that touchdown on the throwing the ball around at the end of the game.
I literally just told you the example of it. It was that Carolina game in 2015.
Carolina got a touchdown from them throwing the ball around?
I mean, what do you mean throwing it? Like
That's what I'm saying, garbage touchdown that the Falcons got to make it an 8-point victory.
Oh, yeah, but them like making a drive down when the Seahawks were leading at the end of the game.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that was a very Seahawks defensive performance. To play like...
And Richard Sherman being upset on the sidelines.
They generally played well. If we want to look at some parallels here, the parallel is the Seahawks are the 2012-11 49ers.
Well, I don't know which year you're looking
for. The year that the Niners went to the Super Bowl and lost to the Ravens. Was that 11 or was
that
12?
Was 11.
The Seahawks are kind of...
Oh, no, that was 12.
The Seahawks are kind of the 2012 Niners. And the Niners are the young upstart team who's like... They have the amazing defense, sort of an unproven quarterback... They're exceeding expectations by a lot, and then their defense collapsed in this one moment where they needed to stop.
But enough about the Falcons game.
What I'm saying, though, is even though, like, I can understand that other situations were worse, and we shouldn't complain because the Seahawks won, this was a process decision, and really
we all know that.
The whole offense... Like, but we don't all know that. Yeah, we've all moved on. Every other fucking person... You want to talk about Seahawks Twitter? Everybody's out there arguing about fucking scenarios with wins and losses, and we won the game, so we're not talking anymore about how the coach made a decision that could have lost them this game and will lose them
in a future
game. No,
it's because everyone always had granted that this is who Pete Carroll is.
We've gotten too rosy.
I mean,
we should be more upset about this 11-3 record. No, it's been an incredible season being at this point where they've clinched. We've clinched the playoffs. Like, yeah. The idea of going to the playoffs, we definitely did not feel confident about that going into the season.
We didn't feel confident about that in the Josh Gordon podcast. I wouldn't re-listen to that, did I?
I remember calling the Cleveland Browns win, the Cleveland Browns game, a must win. To make the play, there were all these scenarios where it was like the schedule is getting a lot harder and the Seahawks won't win these games. And they had the hardest schedule in the NFL. Is that correct?
Then the schedule got a little easier than it seemed.
By strength of schedule, haven't the Seahawks played the hardest record in the NFL, though?
I don't think that's true.
I'm pretty sure that's true. And they are 11-3. So it is good. It's just, it's still, the team is not good enough to make decisions like this. To kick field goals like this. The defense isn't good enough.
Okay. We got it.
I don't think you do got it.
We all got it. We know that Pete Carroll makes bad fourth down decisions. Really, like everyone else has fucking got it.
Okay, fine.
Can we talk about the Cardinals?
I thought you were telling me to wrap it up because we were done with the whole podcast.
Well, we're going
to
talk about that.
We still have to talk about the Cardinals?
Yeah, the Seahawks play a game on Sunday, as we've noted earlier. A streaky season for the Cardinals, who after tying their season opener in the debut for Cliff Kingsbury, lost 3 in a row, then won 3 in a row, then lost 6 in a row to drop 3-9-1 before beating Cleveland on Saturday. Kyler Murray has had a solid rookie season as the number one overall pick. He ranks 14th in QBR, 20th in Ben B's Dakota stat. Only Lamar Jackson is ahead of him from the last two drafts. Definitely a lot of short stuff in the air raid. He's 26th in yards per completion. And given that, taking way too many sacks, 8.7% of dropbacks, which ranks 30th in the NFL, despite above average offensive line play by pass block win rate from ESPN. Part of the reason that he's been more effective than that looks is the Cardinals have played a tough schedule of defenses, the fifth hardest in the league before last week, according to Football Outsiders. And then there's also the rushing value that Kyler Murray provides. He's number 3 in rush EPA behind Lamar Jackson and Deshaun Watson, with Russell Wilson 6th in that category. The Cardinals playing that air raid have really rushed in favorable situations and have dominated on the ground. Okay, you're showing me that they've got the hardest strength of schedule in the league. Okay, thanks. Thanks. Got it. They are number two in rush DVOA entering last week, when they did was run for 226 yards and 6.5 yards per carry against the Browns. Incumbent David Johnson fell out of favor midseason. Chase Edmonds briefly took over the job before suffering a hamstring injury, and then it fell to Kenyon Drake, who, if you managed to make the playoffs with Kenyon Drake, swung things dramatically last week. He has averaged 4.8 yards per carry since his midseason trade from Miami to Arizona, and had 22 carries for 137 yards and 4 touchdowns on Sunday. Larry Fitzgerald, the ageless one, still their top receiving target at 7.5 yards per target. David Johnson has been really effective as a receiver. He's averaging 8 yards per target. And you want to root for targets to the other Johnson rookie, Keyshawn Johnson, not to be confused with Keyshawn Johnson, who is averaging just 4.5 yards per target and has caught just 50% of the passes his way. Nobody else with more than 21 targets for the Cardinals has caught fewer than 65% of their targets. The Arizona defense has gotten a little better over the course of the season. They got Patrick Peterson back from suspension in week 7, but still entered last week 29th in pass defense DVOA. They did manage to hold Baker Mayfield to 5.7 yards per target, and Peterson came up with an interception. The player to watch out for the Seahawks, and the player to watch out for the Seahawks, is Chandler Jones, who comes in with 15 sacks, ranking second in the NFL. He also leads the league with 6 forced fumbles. But he's basically the entirety of their pass rush. Last week, one of those players you wanted to talk about on waivers was Terrell Suggs, who they waived despite his 5.5 sacks. Nobody else on the Cardinals has more than 3, and Cassius Marsh, who got the start and played 70% of snaps on Sunday, has just 1 sack all season after getting waived by the Seahawks. The Seahawks put in a claim for Suggs, but the Chiefs had waiver priority and landed him.
Now, would this have mattered?
I don't know how much he would have played if Clowney and Onsa were both healthy, but maybe.
And he would basically be playing as like an edge rusher.
Yeah, and also he has floated through Adam Schefter that he would only report if he got claimed by the Ravens.
Which seems untrue. A lot of teams putting claims on him.
I think they're calling his bluff.
Well, I mean, it sounds like he's reporting to the Chiefs.
I didn't see any the reporting on that, so.
It sounded like he was going to play for the Chiefs.
Okay.
So. But also, I want to mention that Janoris Jenkins, which...
Yes.
Another one the Saints ended up claiming, who would have been ahead of the Seahawks or behind... How does waiver priority work?
I don't
is
know
it
how...
by playoffs?
I don't know how it works with tiebreakers, and I think it would have been set entering this week because he was waived before these games were played. So I don't think it would update until players who are waived.
So then the Seahawks did not put in a claim on Janoris Jenkins if he fell to the Saints?
That appears correct.
Okay.
Yeah. That's not a position I would want to put in a waiver claim on someone midseason. Place where you want to develop your own guys.
Okay.
All right, thoughts on this week's game? You got nothing here.
You can't judge the Cardinals by their stats. You cannot judge the Cardinals in December in Seattle based upon...
It is tough to say whether it's going to carry over. Like, it obviously did last season without Bruce Arians and Carson Palmer being there, but this is just such a different Cardinals team with Cliff Kingsbury and Kyler Murray that I don't know if the same thing holds. I don't know if they have the same level of Cardinalsness.
The fear still holds.
Oh, for sure.
You're going to say the same thing holds when we lose to the goddamn Cardinals on Sunday. No.
Well, then, yeah, that will be evidence that it holds.
I think that if I can rationalize here.
Oh, if it's the Pelton cast, we can always rationalize.
The teams that the Seahawks lost to continually, the Cardinals teams in December in Seattle, were much better football teams.
Ooh, I'm going to have to disagree with you there. Okay. I mean, they were better football teams,
the
but 2017 the 2017 team wasn't good.
13 Cardinals were 10-6. Like, the Seahawks should, like, that's not that bad of a loss. The 2016 Cardinals.
It is when you win the Super Bowl and you're at home and so haven't lost a home game for like team, 2 years.
The 2016 Cardinals were 10-6-1.
That's too many games.
And 10-5. And the 2017 Cardinals were 500. Like, we're talking 5 wins worse than these teams.
Cardinals are a little better than their record based on their schedule and point differential. I think they're feisty, but I mean the big difference to me is
Bruce Arians had that team ready to play every single week. Same as the Buccaneers. This, like, when the Buccaneers came to town, they were a scarier team.
But not ever
record.
When they played in Arizona. Only when they played in Seattle.
Yeah, for whatever reason they had them ready to play
but
in the city of
also,
Seattle.
But also their tendency to blitz caused the Seahawks great trouble, and this Cardinals team does not appear to do that, even though they brought back Todd Bowles as defensive coordinator.
But they just don't really have the personnel for it. But for whatever reason, those teams really were troubling for the Seahawks. So if I can say that there's a reason that everything is different, the only thing that is the same...
You've just argued against yourself.
I know, but I'm saying I can see it. I can see it both ways. McGuire. But also, we haven't seen it. We have not seen...
That's why I'm sorry. All things are possible.
And we just saw the Cardinals kind of destroy the Browns last week. Mm. Granted, they were playing against a quarterback equally as bad as Kyle Allen, but... They're coming off one of their best wins of the season, maybe their best game of the season. Like, the Cardinals are a pretty good team playing against a banged-up Seahawks team that's looking forward to next week. Like, there's nothing about this that makes me feel confident.
Chances of victory?
Well, okay, I want to get through a couple more thoughts. I think that Kenyon Drake is being a little bit overrated because he...
Because running backs don't matter?
Because running backs don't matter, and also, like, he had a monster fantasy game because he happened to get touchdowns.
Yes. I mean, 4.8 yards per carry is very good, but the Cardinals just run when they have a numerical advantage in the box, which, by the way, is what you should do as an NFL team, as it turns out.
We kind of talked about how that's not the case a couple weeks ago.
What do you mean?
About how you don't just take what the defense is giving you.
Well, they're still running, they're passing the fifth most in neutral situations of anyone in the league. That's not like they're running every single play.
So it's basically like my emotional brain is saying, this is the Cardinals, this is December, it's going to be gross out, there's rain in the forecast.
I haven't looked at the forecast.
Just go look at the forecast and tell me what your percentage chance of victory is after that.
Oh no, why did you bring that up?
But that's the only thing to bring up in December in Seattle.
I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying, why
until they build
up?
The roof that Russell Wilson needs.
So richly deserved. Wait, rain is not necessarily in the forecast.
What do we got here?
My forecast says mostly cloudy.
Oh, this is actually cleared up here
like
a little bit.
Like 20% chance of rain.
Wow, the football gods have shined on Sunday, December 22nd. Because it's showers all week.
They partially shined.
I'm hearing my sources tell me on Twitter... The Seattle weather Twitter accounts that I follow are telling me from my sources that I think Thursday or Friday might be the rainiest day of the year.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, that's the whole year, and we're here in our biological winter.
Oh, no.
But maybe the
come
rain...
Come check on whether it floods in my basement while I'm gone in Vegas.
Maybe the rain will...
55 degrees and sunny.
Tristan Garcino so reporting to you live from Kevin Pelton's basement. That's gonna be me.
Emergency pod on the flood in my basement.
It'll be sideline reporting. It'll be like, Socks, what do you make of all of this water in the basement?
Yeah.
So my emotional brain is telling me this is not a good situation for a football game. But also,
cancel the football game. Move it to Carolina.
The Seahawks are a better team. I don't know if the way that the Cardinals play football is a very conducive way to play football against the Seahawks scheme. The Seahawks love keeping everything in front of them. They love letting you pick up.
So you're saying that the Cardinals are Mike Leach and the Seahawks are Jimmy Lake?
Well, I would not say that about the Cardinals in general, but I would say that potentially about the Kyler Murray, Cliff Kingsbury. I'm only going to say 2019 because everything could be different next year.
Yes.
About this current incarnation of the Cardinals, I think that the Seahawks can keep everything in front of them and make these tackles and eventually get a penalty, incomplete pass, make a mistake, whatever, turnover, whatever, and get them off the field. I don't think the Cardinals are going to score too much in this game. And I do think that the Seahawks will be able to run the ball against the Cardinals, and my cognitive brain or whatever is telling me that this should be a comfortable victory.
So what does that translate into in chances of victory?
So one is like a 70% and one is like a 40%. So I'm going to go with 55%.
I'm going to go with 60 and you're more optimistic. I don't think the Seahawks offense is going to play well. I think it will be okay anyway. Bold prediction. Seahawks get a pick six in this game. I don't know why. I just feel that way.
A pick six?
Yeah.
Wow.
The one that KJ Wright was unable to come up with last week.
Oh.
All right. On that note,
We will be back again later this week to wrap up the decade in Seattle sports
and set your DVRs for Thursday night. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.